tonight on Arena. My Heart Will Go On, Celine Dion on the illness that has stalled her career, and Darren McLachlan on the Say a Song project. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RTE Arena. And we are here in Studio 8 with the freshly formed Allegria Quartet, who will be performing at the West Cork Chamber Music Festival. They have bows poised and they're going to open our session with Grieg's first string quartet in G minor. And this is the opening section. Was Grieg's soaring first string quartet, played by the Allegria Quartet, who are Lucia Murphy on violin, Ksenia Yershova on violin, Conor Galvin on viola, and Adam Joyce on cello. You're playing together at the West Cork Chamber Music Festival, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But Conor, tell us how you four got together.
So we were first approached by Christopher Marwood, who is former cellist to the RTÉ Vanbrugh String Quartet. And he just said, you know, would you be interested in playing with these other musicians? And I think we were all absolutely delighted when he, you know, proposed this idea.
And do you know the others, Ksenia and Lucia and Adam?
We all go back from National Youth Orchestra over the years. I know especially Lucia from, what, 5 years now?
Yeah.
Adam and Ksenia more recently. But yeah, that's where we all met.
And you're from Cork, and you've learned and trained musically in Cork.
Absolutely, yeah, through and through. From I was going to say from day one, but not completely. But we could say that.
And you, Lucia, you're from Limerick.
I am from Limerick, but in TY I started getting lessons in Cork School of Music as well. So yeah, it's fantastic.
All right, and Adam, you're the baby of the group. You're not in. The others have completed their Leaving Cert.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I'm slightly younger. I'm heading into fifth year next year, but I'm definitely strongly leaning towards pursuing music anyway, just a bit later than these guys.
And you're the cellist.
Yes, I am, yeah.
And Ksenia, you were the other violinist along with Lucia.
Yeah.
So you are from Ukraine, and did you come here with your family?
We came here 2 years ago with my family, and I'm extremely happy to join Cork School of Music because it's an amazing place. And right now I just finished the first year in college, so it's an amazing opportunity to pursue my degree here in Ireland.
And you do some playing Ukrainian music with your sister.
Yeah, I'm an artistic director of our family quintet, and we play Ukrainian, classical and Irish music together. There's 5 girls of us, and we play all together music.
All right, and have you played here live and done gigs here in Ireland?
Yeah, quite a lot, actually. We were invited in a different concert. For example, I think the biggest one It was for NSQF gala concert this year and the last summer as well. And we were happy to play on those amazing concerts with other musicians.
Fantastic. And Connor, tell us about that piece we've just heard, the Grieg piece.
Yeah.
Is that a difficult piece for a young quartet like yourselves?
Absolutely. I think the thing with the West Cork Chamber Music Festival is that we have the sort of freedom to propose a programme for ourselves. But obviously that comes with the challenge of finding a piece that will suit our demands and everything. So I proposed the piece originally, and we found it to be slightly more challenging, I think, than originally expected.
And were you happy with this choice, or did you say, Connor, what are you doing?
I think we all agree Grieg is a fantastic piece. It's incredibly challenging and also not as well known as a lot of string quartets, but it's really one of the best pieces of chamber music I've ever heard, and definitely my favourite piece I've ever played myself. So,
and how do you rehearse, Lucia?
When
you're in different places.
Yeah, so we normally go to Cork just because the School of Music, the facilities are great. And for example, for the past 2 days, we've just spent the past 2 days together rehearsing all day, kind of, because, you know, the festival is on Friday, so we have to. And also, yeah, exactly. And myself and Connor had the leaving cert, so obviously there's a bit of a gap while we were doing that. So, but yeah, normally when we do meet up, we do kind of an all-day situation just because it mightn't be that regular, but yeah.
Oh, right. And is it just the four of you, or do you have some leader or somebody watching in and advising you?
At times, we've had coaching from Chris Marwood himself, and he's been really helpful for us and all. But a lot of rehearsing ourselves, and I think it's really good to sort of progress with our own ideas and kind of, you know, be creative. It's great.
Did you know when you knew each other in the orchestra that you might work together someday, or was
I think if you'd told me 5 years ago that I'd probably be stood here right now with, you know, everyone in this room, I probably would call you crazy, to be honest. But I'm happy that I'm here, honestly, you know, with everyone.
And now two of you have done your leaving cert. You're going into leaving cert. What are you hoping to do? Are you hoping to continue music in your life, in your career?
Yeah. I've just received a place to study in the Conservatorium van Amsterdam for classical music, viola. And I've auditioned for a place in a college in Berlin, the Barenboim Side Academy. But, you know, I'd happily accept a place in either college. So once I get the result from Berlin, I'm going to have a tough decision, I think. Well, hopefully a tough decision anyway.
And what about you, Ksenia? Are you, I mean, you're gigging with your family. Is your hope to continue doing that and then do some classical music with the Allegria?
Myself, I'm studying classical music in Cork School of Music in a degree, and I really want to pursue this like further and playing professional music in orchestras. I really love chamber music as well, and playing with my family is more like not additional, but it's kind of family thing. We all love music, we all play music, so I'm the oldest one in the family, and I'm kind of giving it to my sisters, so they also will love music as much as I am.
And do you do other kinds of music? Are you into other, like, more contemporary music?
Lucia is a phenomenal trad player.
A good bit of trad, yeah. So it's nice to have the two, the balance. It's nice to mix between the two, yeah.
All right, so you would do lots of sessions,
trad sessions. Yeah, if I had the chance and the time, yeah, it's great.
I'm sure
I love
in
it,
Bantry
yeah.
now with yeah. a good few sessions.
Yeah. Is it daunting to play Bantry? I mean, it is such an acclaimed festival.
It's a bit scary. I mean,
you've been there, Connor, haven't you?
I've been there, yeah. I was there last year for the first time, and it's an incredible festival, honestly. You're dealing with some of the, you know, top quartets and everything in the world, really, and especially in the European stages. So to have them all in this little town is pretty mental. And then we're arriving with little coaching. You know, a lot of the work we've done is entirely us. So it's kind of scary going in thinking, okay, we're going to see someone who's an idol, really. And then they're they could tear us down, they could build us up, who knows, you know.
And are you going to be able to stay around for the week?
Yeah, we have accommodation for the week, so we'll be living with each other.
Yeah, very exciting.
So, Connor, what's the next piece you're going to play? Some Mendelssohn.
So the next piece is Mendelssohn's Opus 44, number 2, string quartet in E minor. and it's a very nice kind of dark string quartet. It's towards the end of his string quartet cycle. But yeah, I think we all really like this piece. We discovered the later movements more recently, and you know, it's really fun to explore some, even that Grieg is more modern and stuff and more romantic, but even Mendelssohn is just, you know,
it's very dramatic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, let's listen to that now. This is the second movement of Mendelssohn's string quartet, Opus 44, number 2. That was the Allegria Quartet playing the second movement of Mendelssohn's string quartet, Opus 44, number 2. They will be performing at St. Brendan's Hall, Bantry, on Friday the 5th of July as part of the West Cork Chamber Music Festival. To find out more about the festival programme, you can go to westcorkmusic.ie. I'm joined in studio by Deirdre Ní Glacán. Deirdre is an academic, broadcaster and fiddle player. She's part of a young generation of academics, musicians and broadcasters who are on a mission to make the Irish language vibrant and relevant in all its complexity and bring it to a contemporary audience. Her new series on RTE Radio 1 is the Say a Song Project. It's a six-part series where the writers and Shannos artists are invited to reimagine an individual Shanno song and explore what these songs can tell us of modern Ireland. In this week's episode, which is set to air on Sunday, she invites singer Eoin O'Canavan and poet Alva Ní Harvuig to uncover and relive the words of Molly Ní Bhfuil Eoin. And I'm delighted that Deirdre is with me in studio. Where does this great interest in the Shannos tradition come from? You've studied it, I know, academically.
Yeah, I studied it all through my college years, but I'm a Dublin woman, born and bred, and very proud of it. But my mother comes from a Gaeltacht area on the Cork-Kerry border called Cúlé, in the small Gaeltacht of Muskerry. And I suppose there, you know, the songs are part of everyday life and every kind of social gathering. And I suppose I was kind of reared on them through my mother's family. She was very adamant that we would speak Irish at home. And I suppose the songs are as much a part of my identity as anything else.
Yes, because in the documentary, one of the people you talked to is Irlo Linard from Cúlé, of course, and he talked about his Aunt Bessie and about, you know, ever before Sean O'Riordan went to Cúlé, there were people collecting songs and people going to Cúlé.
That's it, I suppose. You know, in 1903, Páraic Pearse himself called Cúlé the capital of the Gaeltacht areas and the capital of Ireland, because it was so rich in its cultural, I suppose, output with music and stories and songs, and the poetry really was a huge thing there. So it's always been a massive part of that area, and I suppose I was just very fortunate to know the right people and to know the people down there that I grew up learning about all the songs.
Yeah, you've great fun when you're talking to Irla in the series, because you talk about the Bessie's collection of songs, that it wasn't just kind of the Shano songs that we would know of heartbreak and sadness, and that there are very raunchy songs as well.
That's it. You know, the famous On Board the Kangaroo, that came from Bess Cronin. She had a great repertoire of, you know, really fantastic, heavy songs that could impress, you know, the best poets in Ireland, but also great character in her songs and the jovial songs. And, you know, she could put great life into them. So that kind of shows, I suppose, the span of emotion and I suppose ambiences that you can create with these songs. She was great.
Oh, and were they all oral? They were all, she had committed those to memory, or had she transcribed them?
No, absolutely committed it to memory. It's a great skill. I often think we spend so much time on our phones now, our memories have degraded through time, but she was fantastic. There's a great book written about Bess Cronin, and they talk about, you know, she could hear a song once and then she'd have it straight away. So not only were you learning, retaining the words, but also the melody. So it was a very musical ear and a very sharp ear, you know, with the language. But yeah, she had, I think there's 84 songs in that collection that Dáimhío Cronin did on Bess Cronin. And she had all of them by memory. And she said herself she'd forgotten more songs than she could recall. So that just goes to show the richness of it.
And now we're heading to the second episode on Sundays, isn't that right?
That's right.
Of the Say a Song project. And this is Molly Navoil Owen. And this is its own account. Yvonne, you talked to about this song. Mm-hmm. Tell us about the song, and what did Owen tell you about it?
Well, you know, it's funny. I actually heard this song for the first time when I was about 14 or 15, and I heard Owen sing the song. We were in school together. Owen was a couple of years ahead of me, and I always really admired him singing this song. And over the years, it never really left me. I always used to think, but it's a Connemara song, so it has nothing to do with my own tradition. That'd be a very, you know, you kind of, I suppose I'd be associated with the Munster Gaeltacht, so would always sing the Munster songs. This is a Connemara song, so it would be sang by people with Connemara Irish who can, pronounce the words correctly in the colloquial language, I suppose, that is used in it. So he was the man for me when I was looking to find somebody who could talk to us about the song.
And it's a song about murder, sung by the murderer.
That's it. It's a very strange song in the sense that we haven't got many murder ballads in the Irish language, but this is a song that was collected from a woman named Sorachan Iruram, who was, I suppose, in her own right, very Cian Rodach. She was an academic herself, and she was a fantastic singer. She spent some time in London as well. And Owen's family, his father Padraig O'Canavan, and he has two sisters, Salogan Moran as well, who are fantastic Shannon singers. So they would be very familiar with the tradition around Iris Anioch and Sorachan Iruram's legacy. So they had all the right information.
So talk us a little bit into the song, because we're going to play it now. Yeah. So he's luring her somewhere because things have gone amiss in their love affair.
Well, this is it. The great thing about these songs is they're very open to ambiguity, which lends itself fantastically well to this project, because it means that we can, you know, go to new places with the translations. But in this song, we're not sure exactly who the murderer is. Is he a member of the clergy? But he lures her behind a temple, a Protestant church, and she has found out that she's pregnant, and so he murders her to keep the secret.
Right, so we're going to listen to this, but he's luring her, so we're not aware for a while what's going to happen.
Absolutely.
Don't come by tonight in long. Why we don't? It's got young lad. I'd gone till so. Agus rach yn yr om na ffrinlad Is ni le grog o man me Ach mar hwl is gymen i brian o En ddwai bi'n catach
That's Ono Canawan there, and he is singing Molly Nivoel Owen. And as I said when I was introducing you, Darren, you then look at what are the contemporary resonances of these songs? And Owen, who is a very political person, as well as being a great singer, he used this song in a very potent way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Owen was involved. He's a great political activist. So I admire all the work that he does. And he was out canvassing for the Repeal the Eighth Fachtas that was going on. And there was a video that circulated online of himself and his sister singing this song. And I suppose I was very struck by the similarities of all the conversations that we as modern Irish women thought, you know, we're faced with these hardships and these decisions to make. And I suppose it was very poignant that these are conversations and situations that have been going on for hundreds of years on this island. It wasn't maybe a question that was unique to just newer generations.
So that is on this one with Ona Canavan. This is on Sunday night. And That's then if it. We skip ahead to Sunday week, we have Irla and Leonard. Mm-hmm. And Irla's song then is about Queen Nidri Vuera. Yeah. So this is a song, it kind of relates to the crucifixion and also to women who from time immemorial have been mourning the dead or a relative or a beloved.
Absolutely. The refrain in this song is Ó Chonó, and you know that would come from the ancient tradition of keening, or so a ban chinta, we all know what her function was. But this particular song tells the story of Mary lamenting the death of her son Jesus, and it's sung at a lot of the time in Easter, still very prominent in all the Gaeltacht areas. There's different versions up and down Ireland, but I suppose, you know, what's very poignant about this song at the minute, even though it's telling us a story that goes back over 2,000 years, you know, in certain parts of the world, these are very real experiences of children, of mothers with their children, and everything that's going on in Gaza and in Palestine at the moment. So it just goes to show the duality of these songs and how relevant they are to the modern lived human experience. You know, the human condition doesn't change. We're very earthy people.
Irla, in his very interesting conversation with you, was talking about almost getting ready to do a song and to be able to get into a song. He talked about that song in relation to, you know, when he felt the time was right to sing it.
Absolutely. You know, the Seanós tradition is very potent, and you know they often say when people would be giving you advice on how to sing the song that you really have to embody the emotions. It's a very, you hear it there from Ó Canavan singing, it's like something from another time. You know, you have to take on the words and the emotion yourself, and it can be quite heavy, and you can feel it in a room when someone is singing a song. They really believe these emotions, and you know they're putting their own life experience into it. So I think that's something that maybe isn't as prominent in English language singing, but it's a very instinctive thing in Seanós singing, and Irla was referring to that, and I think he's another great example of a singer who can do that.
That's right, and people should listen out for the Ó Chonó and how he sings it. It's heartbreaking. So let's listen to Irla Leonard. There's Irla Leonard there singing that Queen Nidri Vuera. And then for the contemporary resonance again, you talk to Philly Speaks.
Yeah, Absolutely. So my conversation with Feli Speaks was, it was so interesting because we sat down, I suppose, with all the artists that are involved in this project. I had initial chats with them and wanted to know what themes they were exploring in their work at the minute. What were they interested in learning more about to, you know, try find songs that would match up with them. And through my chat with Feli Speaks, we found that there was a huge correlation between the Nigerian history of lamentation or keening and the Irish tradition of keening. And very similar to what we had here for hundreds of years, they had a thing very similar to a band Chinta over in Nigeria, who, you know, would be hired out and essentially perform the same functions as a keening woman here in Ireland. So again, you know, when we go back far enough, we're also similar, all these indigenous cultures.
And was it through conversation with Philly that those ideas came about? Or, I mean, she's obviously very engaged with Irish song.
Well, that's it. Well, you know, I suppose the point of this project was to try and get as diverse and as wide a range of the modern lived Irish experience. And Feli Speaks was talking to me a lot about the problems and the campaigning that was going on within the Black Irish community at the time. And I suppose she was very involved in the social justice campaign for George Nkencho, and she really wanted to develop a piece of work that honoured his memory. And it was through that conversation, and again, what happened with George Nkencho's mother witnessing his death, there was so many similarities in that story and in Cuidin the Drivore and in a lot of the stories and material from the Nigerian culture. To be honest, I'd like to say that I had a light bulb moment, but it was hitting us in the face. It was so obvious once we scratched the surface that there was so many similarities there.
Now, the episode people would have missed is one with Ciarán O'Ganavan, and that's Uncanny Bawn. Yes. So that's about a ship.
That's it. That's it. You know, there's great ties between Waterford and Newfoundland. And we kind of, it was Theo Dorgan actually who found this song first. He was involved in the project and he kind of had me on a wild goose chase because I wasn't familiar with the song at all. So we were up and down into libraries and archives trying to learn more about it. So I enlisted the help of An Dochtúir Lile Soléire, who's a great friend and mentor of mine, and An Dochtúir Ciarán O'Ganavan. And luckily they were able to fill in the gaps for me. So there was great, a very rich history there. And again, I suppose, you know, that life at sea and fishing and, you know, that's maybe something that in mainstream media now, these days, we're not doing enough talking about it at all, but something that's been very prominent in Irish life. And, you know, when we look at socioeconomic problems that are going on in Europe as well, something that's very prevalent and that we need to spend more time talking about.
Well, the series sounds fascinating. And how many more after the Irla? How many altogether? Six?
So we have six altogether. Yeah. So we've one down, six to go. And
all made?
They're all done now.
Yeah, man, Colin.
Exactly. So I can relax now. And I must, I made a promise as well that I'd mention the Folly Festival in Laois that's happening in 2 weeks' time. So that there's great contemporary music happening there with great bands like The Scratch that are doing, you know, modern things with the tradition. So if you want to get a taster of that, make sure you're in County Laois now.
So it's called the Folly Festival.
The Folly Festival, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Lovely. Mm-hmm. Dúran Glacán. Gurb míle mahagat.
Gurb míle mahagat, sir.
You can catch episode 2 of the song, project on RT Radio 1 at 7 p.m. on Saturday, the 30th of June. Celine Dion is the ultimate diva of the power ballad, and she's been missing from her punishing concert schedule since 2020. 17 years ago, she began to experience some voice spasming. It steadily became worse, causing her to self-medicate in order to get her through concerts. In a new documentary, I Am Celine Dion, the superstar comes clean about her illness, a neurological disorder called stiff person syndrome. The diagnosis, the disorder attacks the muscular system, causing spasms, breathing problems and chronic pain. Crucially, for one of the most celebrated and technically gifted singers, it affects her voice. In this new film, Celine Dion sheds light on what her life has been like since she cancelled shows in Las Vegas and how she is dealing with the lack of control of her own voice and body. I'm joined now by Cian Sullivan, who's been watching I Am Celine Dion. So it really is a documentary about about what has happened to her in illness wise, rather than her life story, even though we get lots of life story as well.
Absolutely. Like, if people are here for a career retrospective on Celine Dion, you're not really getting it in this documentary. Yeah, you're getting sort of interstitials of past performances showing off like how booming and amazing that voice is and how sort of dynamic she was on stage. But more so, this is a fly in the wall of her Nevada mansion when she is at the lowest of her low. You know, not only is she struggling physically, she's struggling mentally, she's struggling with her sense of self. Now that she has been stripped of this big voice, she's having a sort of an identity crisis, and that's where you see her in this documentary.
Yes, because from the opening titles with Carmen, Bizet's Carmen playing underneath, you kind of know this is going to be a tragic, this is a tragic tale.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you that's kind of cut with these pictures of her as a young woman, and I guess it kind of reminds you that she has been, or tells you quite sort of in so many words, that she has been Celine Dion, the singer, since she's been 12 years old, you know. And I think part of the struggle that she is dealing with in this documentary is, and I think the words she used are, her voice has been the conductor of her own life. You know, she has been a singer since the age of 12, and now this voice is gone from her, and she's kind of, you know, trying to pick up the pieces, trying to make sense of it all.
Let's hear her talking about that, about it being the conductor of her her life.
Was the conductor of my life. It was I was following it. You lead the way, I follow you. And I was okay with that because I was having a great time. When your voice brings you joy, you're the best of yourself, you can be the leader. My ego is not that big. If you want to take that role, take it. I don't care. I'm having a good time here.
There she goes. She's having a good time here. So she was willing to give everything over to the voice. Whether she's a big ego or not is another question. But how do we find out then? Or, you know, they kept it secret. Mm. People knew that Celine Dion wasn't well. She lives in Las Vegas. She had shows going on in Las Vegas. She couldn't go outside the door because she, you know, she couldn't.
Dion.
Yeah, she's Celine Dion and she couldn't perform. So how slow was the progression into deciding she couldn't sing anymore?
So yeah, so you mentioned 17 years, and that's the number that's bandied around in the documentary. But then she also says this sort of started during her Taking Chances World Tour, which was in 2008. So it's going back as far as this, and she kind of owns up to the deception that her and her team have been running for the last, whatever, 15 years of dropping the keys of the songs to make them easier to sing, that she's holding out the microphone to the audience because she's afraid she's not going to hit the note. They are, you know, saying she's got an ear infection, an eye infection, all the while she's hiding this, you know, syndrome that's getting worse and worse, and she's pushing through it, and she, you know, is possibly
and medicating herself
and
to a frightening level.
Yeah, 80 to 90 milligrams of Valium a day she was on to try relax the muscles that would allow her to sing. So the phrase she uses in the documentary was that the lie was becoming too heavy to carry anymore, and that was sort of her motivation to reveal in 2022 that she has this, you know, rare neurological disorder, but also to do this documentary to give this warts and all view of her life at, you know, arguably her lowest time or one of her lowest times.
Now, in another part of the documentary, she compares herself to an apple tree and how people line up to collect her apples, but her branches are starting to produce fewer and fewer apples.
They paid a lot of money around the world to come and see our shows. I feel like, let's say, there's an apple tree. I'm an apple tree. And people are in line, and I give them apples, the best, and I shine them. And they all leave with a basket of apples. And my branches are starting to fall sometimes, get crooked. And those branches are starting to produce a little less apples. But there's still as many people in line. Thank you. I don't want them to wait in line if I don't have apples for them.
So going a bit far with the metaphor there, but that's Celine Dion.
That is Celine Dion.
I am Celine Dion. But that would belie that a lot of it is quite upbeat. Like she can break into song. I know she can sing a full song, but she is full of joie de vivre a lot of the time.
One thing that's encouraging if you are a Celine Dion fan is that she, despite all of this, she seems to have not lost her sense of humour, her sense of self. Like you said, she is willing to break into song at the drop of a hat. And at times, you know, at the start of the documentary, she breaks into song and realizes that she can't sing and then bursts into tears. You know, she speaks, as we heard her there, she speaks extemporaneously as if she's delivering a Shakespeare soliloquy. Do you know, I saw her in some of the promo for this documentary and she delivers her lines straight down the barrel of the camera. Like she's kind of always on and always performing. She loves a cliche, she loves an analogy. One that I really liked was a French one, which was artiste un jour, artiste toujours, an artist for one day, an artist forever. You know, she hasn't lost herself, her sense of self, which I think is encouraging, I guess, for fans.
Yes,
of
and
hers.
She's presenting herself in a very austere way,
yeah,
like minimal makeup, hair pulled back, as you say, staring straight into the camera.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you're watching this woman sort of have this crisis, but you're in the backdrop of this palatial mansion, like it's gorgeous, classical French style. There's these opulent, ornate, golden picture frames. There's these big canvases with paint leaning against the walls. Her twin sons have their own game room where they have this big, like, plush armchair, and the TV is, like, built into the armchair. So you see the sort of luxury and the privilege that she lives in. But what stuck out to me anyway, was the reminder that, like, even if you have this comfort, you know, that your heart doesn't break anymore because of this illness. And you can really see, you know, she might be lying on a comfortable couch, but she is ultimately stuck on the couch for a period of time. She can't really move. And I think it was honest and vulnerable of her to show herself without the makeup, without the glitz, without the glam. We know she loves the glitz and the glam, and there's aspects of that in the documentary, but she's willing to sort of bare all to show what's really going on with her.
Now we know she goes the whole hog when she's performing and how she dresses. Mm. And there are wonderful scenes when she's in like a storage area in her home, like it is a warehouse of all her costumes. And then she'll talk in detail, like there's a jacket which is very much like a matador's jacket, all ornate and gold, and she tells in detail how they had to get the blouse to go inside it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's these cuffs that you know you don't want the full sleeve, you add a cuff there. She'll pick up a pair of shoes and she can remember that the Chanel, you know, straight off the back. The space of this storage container, like whatever you're picturing, it is 10 times bigger than that. It's absolutely huge. It doesn't even just contain all of her clothes. There was Tupperware boxes of toys for the kids aged 5 to 8 or whatever. Like every aspect of her 50 years on this world seems to be contained in this storage center.
Yes, she's going out of the warehouse at one stage and she says, she points at something, she goes, oh, I must have liked that. I've made 4 of them.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But so there's a little control freakery. I mean, she didn't get where she is without knowing every detail or at least being the coordinator of all this perfection.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like the fashion is a really clear way in how the control freak manifests. But also you see it just in subtle ways, which I think is really tasteful in the documentary. You know, she opens up a drawer to get out a Sharpie and there's about 20 Sharpies in they're colour-coded from like red to green. You know, they move into one different sitting room to record a video for something and the dust left on by her kids, she has to go up and hoover. You know, she talks about her career and how
her socks. Don't forget the socks.
The socks, the immaculately folded socks.
Mm-hmm. Marie Kondo.
Eat your heart out, Marie Kondo. You know, she talks about being jealous of other singers who were able to drink alcohol and still sing. I feel, you know, she's had this vice grip level of control, I think, because her career has been so big and spiraling, she needs that sense of control, I guess, to ground her. And that comes across in the documentary.
And her humour comes across as well. There's a great scene from Jimmy Fallon where she takes off Sia and she has, she puts her hair over her face to, you know, to show herself as the singer, the famous singer.
Yeah, absolutely. And then there's the clip from Carpool Karaoke where her and James Corden recreate the sort of Titanic scene in a fountain in Las Vegas. So, yeah, they do snap back to those areas where she is herself. And you see she hasn't lost that self. And that's something that's kind of made her this kind of camp classic as well as being a powerhouse diva.
What do you see as her? You know, have you seen her live
shows? I haven't,
shows?
No, but I...
Right, but you've seen her show.
Yeah.
Yes. So how would you describe a Celine Dion show?
I think there's a real balance of sort of classicism, but also quirkiness, I think, because she is this big singer. She, you know, she comes from this French background. There's all is a classic imagery. There's white horses, there's billowing curtains. But then she is herself just sort of effortlessly kind of kooky, and she pulls these faces and stuff, which I think is kind of what makes her, it kind of breaks the austereness of it all. And I think, you know, powerful voice aside, there's a fun to it all.
Now there are harrowing scenes on this. I mean, she decides to show her illness, or to show the pain she is in all the time. How is that portrayed in the documentary?
Yeah, so you kind of see or hear her mention, "Oh, my legs are getting sore. I need to sit down," when she's kind of moving about her life and doing things, but you don't really see an attack, I guess is what you'd call it, or a series of spasms, until kind of towards the end. She's recording a few vocal takes of her song Love Again, which is from the movie Love Again, which she was in with Priyanka Chopra. And the voice is beginning to get worse and worse, and she's asking for another take, and she fails, and she fails worse and worse each time. And the emotional distress of that sends her into this spasm where her physio is trying to calm her down, and it ultimately ends in her whole body is as stiff as a board. Her face is contorted into this emotion that you can only call as horror. You know, and
this lasts a long time.
It lasts a long time. I think, you know, at one point they say if we, you know, we've admit 20 minutes on, we have to give her second, I guess it's like a nasal agent that releases the muscles or something like that. You know, if this is still going for another 7 minutes or whatever, we're going to have to call 911. You really see how debilitating these spasms are. And she's spoken about how one of the spasms broke her rib and stuff in the past. So like, it is incredibly debilitating. And that is probably that is the sense of horror that comes across the documentary towards the end.
And is there any sense of hope in it that she will sing again? I mean, that is her aim and her hope, obviously.
Yeah. It ends in a note, I would say, more of defiance, a defiant hope rather than a hope that feels palpable to the viewer. You know, she talks about if she can't run, she'll walk. If she can't walk, she'll crawl, but she will, you know, she will ultimately sing again. One thing I think is, I think a bit of a disappointment with the documentary is in the promo for this documentary, because she's unable to have a conversation without breaking into song. She's broken into song when she's done interviews with CBC or ABC, and her voice sounds pretty good. So, I mean, I have a lot more hope having seen the promo for this documentary than I did the documentary itself. And I'm comparing it to Shania Twain had a documentary in which she talks about her vocal cords and Lyme disease. And that ended in a more like, I've come through it all, here I am. And I wonder whether, you know, another year or something could have left the documentary on a more, I guess, positive note.
Okay, well, let's listen to some Celine. It's all coming back to me now. There she goes, Celine Dion. My thanks to Cian Sullivan. I Am Celine Dion is available worldwide on Prime Video tomorrow. That's it for tonight's show. The programme was researched by Leah Murphy and Barbara Rosanmo. Mark McGrath and Niall McMonagle were on sound. Ollie Hamilton is the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Therese Kelly, and Jordan Creedon is next after the news at 8.